Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This podcast often deals with graphic, violent, and horrific crimes against men, women, and children. Please listen at your own discretion. If you are affected by any of the themes featured in this episode, please contact your local support charity.
It was an initiation into the triads, as you probably know.
They are operating just like the mafia, Italian mafia, as triads in Hong Kong.
The person I was told belonged to the same triad group as the ringleader.
Join our group or else you'll be beaten. Seriously.
We're using him to be our detective in a sense. Well, where we can't tread, they can tread. Someone was overheard talking.
He bragged about being worth $500,000, you know.
He's confessed. He said, I did it. I did that case.
I knew in my bones that this was the right man, and he exuded absolute evil. This was Braemar Hill.
Catching Worms, a Hong Kong true crime podcast. Months had passed since that day that Nicola Myers and Kenneth McBride took a walk up Braemar Hill, only for their bodies to be found the next day, bound and brutally beaten. There had been twists and turns along the way, with an early tip-off to a gang in Quarry Bay that led nowhere, to profiling and interviewing a known group in Kowloon with a history of attacks that fitted the bill. Yet, the police were no closer to finding the Braemar Hill killers. Detective Norrie MacKillop had not given up hope.
I was always very, very optimistic, and I'll tell you why. It's because I believed that there was a minimum of three people involved in the killings. And when you have more than one person involved in the killing, there's always there's a strong possibility that one of them will speak. One of the perpetrators in their heart or hearts, believe that they're less culpable than the others. And sooner or later, and in my own experience over the years, someone talks and someone is overheard talking in the most unlikely places, like a tea house or whatever, just careless talk, because there's usually a ringleader when there's more than one person involved in a murder like this. And as I said, the one who feels he's less culpable, whether he's less culpable or not, is a matter for the court. But that's when chit-chat starts, and hopefully chit-chat is picked up by someone.
So they were waiting for chit-chat. But Hong Kong isn't a place for idle talk. So what were the next steps? The investigation needed fuel, and that fuel would only come from leads and tip-offs from the public. Although months had passed, Hong Kong was still in shock. Nothing like this had ever happened to the expat community, and they wanted the killers found.
Now, you probably recall there was a reward for for this case. The donor of the reward remains anonymous to this day. So there was quite a substantial amount offered as a reward for information leading to the arrest of the killers.
And
how much do you think it was would be today, roughly? Like, I don't know if you know the maths, but it's not really about that. Like, in terms of, like, over a million?
Millions, yeah. So because 500,000, it's a huge amount, yeah. 500,000, so you can, I believe you can buy a flat. Of course, nowadays you can you know, get a flat for at least $10 million in Hong Kong.
In order to help the investigation, an anonymous Hong Kong businessman made a substantial donation to be given to anyone who could provide critical information that might lead to a conviction. But a public baited by fortunes for information can open up the doors to conspiracy and fallacious confessions. A special hotline for the case had been set up, and that phone began to ring. Was this problematic? I wanted to understand the concerns from Detective Trevor Collins.
And off the back of that hotline, or off the back of your investigations, there was a reward offered for information. With that amount of information coming in, was that a good thing at the time? Were you worried about the amount of information that you'd be receiving?
It makes life more difficult. Obviously, you've got lots and lots of information. You're trying to sort of go through it to wheedle out the rubbish and the good stuff from the good stuff. But yeah, it's good that you do get more than less. And then the anonymous donation made a big difference, of course.
So how this would work traditionally is that every call would be logged on a card, and every card would be placed in boxes in a big, literal filing system. They also had information coming in from police stations across Hong Kong who were on the alert for any suspects with similar characteristics to the gang profile they had built. But to locate and select which card to deal with next was a highly manual process. The detectives on this case wanted to work in a different way, so commenced the first computerised investigation in Hong Kong.
So we were stuck with a whole mass of a huge volume of information because of that. And we had a couple of guys, one that worked for me, a senior inspector, who was a bit of a computer buff in the early days. He suggested that perhaps we could set up some sort of database, as it would be called now, I suppose. And we managed to get the assistance from Hong Kong Telecom, and they gave us, lent us six computers, basic computers, just so we could have people 24 hours inputting information. And then one master computer where this database system could sort of pick out people that were stopped or identified as being involved in perhaps sexually motivated crimes, such as, you know, rapes in parks and such like.
So with the computers whirring and information flooding in, they were just waiting for that gold dust tip-off. Gangs in Hong Kong are affiliated with triads. Triads are members of criminal organisations or secret societies that are shrouded in mystery. These organised gangs have wielded influence in Chinese society for centuries. Following Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution in the 1970s, many triads relocated to the British colony of Hong Kong. Famed for controlling the illicit trades in gambling, drugs and prostitution, they have a fearsome reputation. However, their role in Hong Kong society was more nuanced. There were hundreds of different triad groups with various affiliations and their own particular code of loyalty and brotherhood. To get a better understanding of these career criminals, I asked Inspector Joseph Sanchez. He grew up in Hong Kong and is no stranger to the gang operations on the streets.
The triads, they're different. Many, many triads in Hong Kong those days. Now, there are only a few because, to be honest, many of them fear the Chinese government. So, yes, the triad is a bit like suppressed in a sense, but not too, because they will operate anyway. They are in the dark. So, yes, those days there were a lot of segments, little segments. You mean names of this triad?
For someone who doesn't know what a triad is, or what is a triad?
All locals know, even foreign visitors, I mean, from a Hong Kong view, they know. Triad is like, how do I put it? It's a long story. It's about history. They used to protect the government, and now they are all making use of the government to make money, even bad money, illegal monies.
So was a lot of the crimes?
Yes, they are all connected. All connected. Vice activities, which means in Hong Kong it is dangerous drugs. Those days we still have opium, and up to now we still have these cracks and things. And also, what was that? Even the disposal of stolen properties, they're all triad related. Dangerous drugs, vice, and illegal gambling, they operate casinos. So, yeah, underground casinos. They are operating just like the mafia, Italian mafia, as in triads in Hong Kong. So what the association was is they will usually send out a person who can lead a few people only. This person, I'll call it person A, he will approach you and then said, come on, join our group or else you will be beaten. Seriously. And then in Chinese too. So they will usually recruit you in a playground, you know, public playground, like a football pitch or something like that, open to public. They would target boys like 14, 15 years old. And then sometimes it happened in private schools. Private schools in Hong Kong is different from the concept of private schools in the UK. They are just some, you know, operating on a business registration certificate those days. They don't even have a license. So students who are in there, most of them are triad members, we were told. Okay, so like if there are 20 students in the class, you can expect like 10 to 15 of them are triad members or triad related. Okay, my brother is already a triad member, so I don't want to join you. So they can give excuses like this. So when they were kicked into the society, into the association, there will be a ceremony for it to formalize your identity as a normal member. You will pay some money, just a little bit, to make sure that you are a member of them. Okay, a sort of consideration, I suppose. So they will start, you know, kicking members, a lot of them. So one time we were told that there were tens of thousands of triad members in Hong Kong. Tens of thousands, like 3 to 4 times of the Royal Hong Kong Police strength at that time, those days.
I asked journalist Tony Flores what the general public thought of triads.
Were people at the time in Hong Kong generally afraid of the triads?
Oh, yes, yes. They're generally afraid because basically they're bullies. You know, if you offend them, they'll just do anything.
So was this crime triad related? Had Nicola and Kenneth got caught up in something they couldn't get out of? For Detective Nori McKillop, this made no sense.
There's always suspicions that triads are involved in all kinds of cases. But there was no suspicion in this particular case that Nicola and Kenneth were targeted by triads. There had been absolutely no reason to target them. There was also speculation about it being connected with in these days, 1984, there was bad blood between China and Hong Kong and the British government over the handover negotiations, etc. So there was speculation that somehow that was involved in it. But we ourselves at the Centre of Investigation just ignored this kind of conjecture. We dealt with the evidence. There was no evidence of any triad involvement. And when I mean triad involvement, I mean these victims being targeted by triads.
With all these speculations, Detective Nori McKillop's theory was about to pay off.
Now, after we discounted the Kowloon gang, which were really pretty high on our suspect list, but after I interrogated them, I was pretty convinced that they're, although they were convicted of many, many brutal crimes and sexual offences and robberies, they weren't involved in this case. But it was some months later that someone was overheard talking.
And from the back of his donation offer, you received a bit of a tip-off. So how did you progress from there? How did you progress from that first initial tip that was received?
Right, so the initial information came in, and then we had to try and verify it.
This is Detective Trevor Collins.
The source of the information initially was a bit reluctant to let it be known. He just thought he could give the information and that would be it, and he'd get the reward. It doesn't work that way, obviously.
Interview him, find out the circumstances. What did he overhear? Where was he when he overheard this? Who was in the group? Where were they? Who was there? Who was in the group? Describe them. Try and get close to them. Go back to them again. Find out more information, and it's gradually build up. In fact, we're using him to be our detective in a sense, but with strict guidance and getting the information that we can't get ourselves. We can't send a detective in there to do what he's doing because, you know, we would stand out. The detective would stand out. So it was quite sensitive. So we call it informant handling. We actually had professional informant handlers in the police force who were trained to handle informers like this and deal with them sensitively and get as much information and essentially use them as an arm of, like a detective, but under strict guidance.
Like other organised crime groups, such as the Japanese Yakuza, triads have elaborate initiation ceremonies. Traditionally, a typical ceremony was said to take place beneath an altar dedicated to Guan Yu and include an animal sacrifice. After drinking a mixture of wine and blood, usually from a chicken, the new member would pass beneath the Arch of Swords and take their oath as a triad member. However, by the 1980s, initiation was not always so ritualised, yet new members were still expected to prove themselves. As teacher Chris Force recalls,
this was an initiation procedure that just really, really went wrong under the evil eye of Pang.
The person, I was told, belonged to the same tribe group as the ringleader.
Journalist Tony Flores.
Of this particular crime. And that's how he sought him out, you know, told the police that, you know, they suspect this guy's acting suspiciously or whatever.
The ringleader he speaks of was 24-year-old Pang Shun-Yi. He was a member of the Fuk Yi Hing Triad Society and was overheard at a triad dinner, as Detective Trevor Collins recalls.
You know, you get the spring dinners and such like. And they do have dinners for a number of reasons, birthdays, whatever. It's just like normal people. They'd have a function. Everyone would be invited. You've got the boss there who wants to show his power all the time. He likes to call in all the troops. And, of course, the Fuk Yi Hing is not a particularly big tribe society, but they had the dinner and, yeah. Young Pang came up and asked for help.
Apparently, the rumours then was that he was bragging that he bragged about being worth $500,000, you know. And the triad member, a friend of his, gave information to the police, and that's how they caught him.
And it took a bit of cajoling to get him to finally agree. He was in the middle ranks of the triad society, and it was at a dinner where the first defendant, Pang, came up to the main table and asked for help because he'd done that case. And of course, they thought he was joking to start with. He got a carton of cigarettes and a couple hundred dollars, I think it was, and, you know, told to go away and keep quiet.
And is it unusual that you would get someone from a triad supplying that kind of information to the police?
Yeah, very, very unusual. I mean, it's they take the oath of secrecy and the rest of it, and certainly don't roll over on your associates. I mean, it's one of the things that to gain notoriety and promotion within triads is to be convicted of an offence. And obviously, the more serious the offence, the more notoriety you get. They're certainly not going to make an issue that, oh, he's done this case, so we'll get him banged up, because then he can be really famous. He's a follower of mine, and I'll get face as well. It was purely because of the money, the amount of money involved. It's the first time that amount of money had ever been offered.
Because I think that was one of the things that struck me as unusual, because I would think if they were in the same triad group, it would be unusual for someone to tell. Mm. Do you think that's unusual?
Yes, but I think at the time, someone had offered a $500,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the person or persons. And at that time, $500,000 was a lot of money. I think really the tip was, without the tip, I also didn't expect the police would ever be able to crack the case. It could be anybody. So many people go up to the hill. And they interview thousands and thousands of people, and they got nowhere, although they got some information, but they got nowhere.
So this $500,000 reward was a game changer. They had the tip. They had a name, Pang Shengyi. But now they needed to arrest the full gang to get to the truth.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
As far as the police knew, Nicola and Kenneth had no connections to the triads, no connections to Pang Shengyi, and had simply gone to Braemar Hill to study on that sunny Hong Kong Saturday in April. Star students, passionate young people full of life, that day they met their death. Was their fate a matter of pure coincidence? Detective Norrie MacKillop needed an arrest to get to the full story. His key was a mid-level triad member from the Phuc Yi Hing Triad Society, known as the informant.
A person who became our informant and came forward with the information that he had overheard a person boasting about being involved in the murder of Europeans and stealing the shoes. And he followed that person to the approximate place where he lived. And it turned out he lived in a squatter area. There were still some squatter areas around in 1984, though Murray McLebose had cleared up a huge amount of the squatter areas when I arrived in the early 70s. But there were still quite a few squatter areas around.
Detective Norrie MacKillop continues to describe what these squatter areas were like.
Yeah, wooden huts in the hillside, tin huts, not very far from where the murders took place, not a huge distance, easily walkable, but very difficult for police to get in and out without. They're very tight-knit communities. So it doesn't mean these people are bad people because they live in squatter areas, by no means. They just lack public housing. And their kids go to school just as clean as any other kids go to school. You've probably seen them. I've seen them in the Walled City going to school in pristine white uniforms. This is no different. So it doesn't mean that because people live in the squatter area that they're in any way criminals. But he lived in that squatter area.
The police had been searching this area of Hong Kong for months. They had gone door to door, speaking to everyone who would have been in that area at the time. On a map, they had drawn an ever-widening circle around the scene. This squatter's area was inside that circle, yet no reports had come in, and Pang Shengyi's name was not on their suspect list.
Although it took us a long time to finally catch the guys, we were unfortunate in that concentric circle sort of checking we'd done. We'd bypassed Pang's where he was living.
This is Detective Trevor Collins,
which was in the Mount Butler mine area, quarry area, and they had a hut inside the quarry area where his father, I think, was the caretaker, and it's something we actually overlooked, and it may have made life a lot easier. Who knows?
So you mentioned that his location was almost missed by the investigation. Was that because it was such a poor area? Why was that area missed?
Well, because it's not really a residential area. It's, you've got Mount Butler, massive government quarters there. And then you've got another couple of buildings in front of Mount Butler. And then the road comes to a dead end. And then you have a country path which goes round, and you can walk all the way round. And it eventually comes to Braemar Hill. Go all the way down, all the way, Sulky One down there. So patrols were sent out to interview people found on those walkways. But where this quarry was, it's quite near to where the police open air range course there. But it's a quarry type, it's an old quarry type place. And inside this quarry type place is that there's a hut type place that Pang's family used to live in.
So close, yet they had missed the house of the gang's ringleader. Pang's proximity to the scene provides another motive, as journalist Tony Flores speculates.
Eventually we got information that they arrested the ringleader, and he lived in Quarry Bay, just on the other side of the country park. I believe that was why he ordered that the two teenagers be killed, because he was worried about being recognized. From Braemar Hill to where he lived in Quarry Bay, I think it was several kilometres away.
The police did finally arrest Pang, but it wasn't a fast process. They couldn't just storm into the squatters' area and arrest one man when they knew
there would be three or more people, we thought, from the way the bodies were found. From the injuries, from the fact that Kenneth, despite his arm being in a sling, would have put up a terrific struggle. And Nicola also. And she was naked. It was quite clear that there was a sexual attack on her. So it would be very difficult for even two people to handle two fit young people like Kenneth and Nicola. So we're looking at a minimum of three people, probably more.
So how would they identify the entire gang from this one tip-off?
We just had a nickname at that time. But we had a squatter area where he might be living. So we put that area under surveillance, 24-hour surveillance, night and day, with night viewing and trying to identify this person. And eventually we did a lot of research, and over the next few months, being patient, we managed to identify other suspects who were part of Pang Xiongyi's group.
Detective Norrie MacKillop.
By cultivating the informer and then sort of leading him into trying to get more identification, get the proper name, find out where the people live, get more information, etc. Over a matter of weeks and a month or so, we managed to get sufficient information through that informer, which enabled us to identify what we believe was the whole gang.
The informant was a mid-level triad member who had his eyes on the prize.
And thank God, maybe because of this person who offered the reward that lure the person out to give information.
Journalist Tony Flores. So how do you picture this gang in your head? It was the 1980s. Were they driving fast cars? Tough guys with tattoos and weapons at their disposal. High-level criminals moving in circles with the rich and famous. This isn't a movie, and this isn't the type of gang they found.
I don't know if you recall, you probably weren't in Hong Kong at the time, Susie, but in the old days, you know, when you got a taxi to the Star Ferry, quite often there'd be a group of kids, youngsters, would open the doors looking for a tip for opening taxi doors. Well, they were a group that hang around Star Ferry. They were part of this group that could be found hanging around Star Ferry opening taxi doors. So they were virtually the youngsters in the group. You could call them street urchins, to use an old-fashioned term. But Pang Xiongyi was no street urchin. He was older, and one of the other group was actually older than him.
Mr. John Haynes Esquire represented one of the younger members of the gang, Chang Yao Hang, at his appeal, and sheds more light on the daily lives of this type of gang.
He'd come from a busted home, and his new stepfather didn't like him, and he'd been chucked out of the house, so he was homeless at the age of 15. And the only way he got any money to get food was by opening doors for taxis at the Martao. And of course, those people who were allowed to open doors and get tips were only allowed to do it by the local triad, who at the end of the day came and took all their money, but gave them food and lodging. And this displaced poor teenager was living that kind of life. And his boss man, he told me once, which I thought graphically illustrated the difference. He said, yes, they gave us some kanji every morning in our lodging, but the bosses had meat and stuff in their kanji and we only had rice. Just unimaginable.
So we developed the information through the informant and managed to positively identify the names, even the addresses of virtually all the gang. So on the day when we decided to make our arrests, we used the whole of the Organised Serious Crime Bureau.
The entire OCB. Because, as Detective Norrie MacKillop explains, it was very important that these arrests happened at the same time.
When we're pretty sure that we had them all, as we call it, housed, they all housed. We know where each one of them is at a specific time. So we could do simultaneous raids, as we call it, simultaneous arrests. So we didn't want to arrest one, couldn't find the others, and then the others would become aware of an arrest, so they'd all talk, and then they'd get the stories all in line, etc. So it's quite important to get simultaneous arrests.
Do you feel like you get a sense when you meet a potential suspect very quickly,
yes,
very early on?
It's extraordinary that you actually say this to me, but it's happened to me several times, and this was one of the cases where it did happen to me. Pang Xiongyi, who was, when he was eventually arrested, I would say he was the ringleader of the group. My team went to arrest him, and we rounded up the whole gang eventually, almost simultaneously. Anyway, my team was looking for Pang Xiongyi. So we went into where he was hiding. The moment I set eyes on him, I knew instinctively that this was the right person. And it was quite creepy, actually. It's only happened to me one other time in one other case, but I was just convinced, of course, that won't stand up in a court of law. Of course, I wouldn't expect it to, but I knew in my bones that this was the right man, and he exuded absolute evil.
Detective Nori McKillop's team went to arrest Pang Shengyi. I asked him to talk me through how the arrest went down.
Oh, we just went straight into the house, and I always remember he had his back to me when I went in. And I knew immediately, because we didn't have a photograph of him, I knew immediately just by instinct. It was not something I would say in evidence in court, but I knew this is the man. And he was cautioned immediately, and he didn't say anything. He refused to cooperate with us in any way, even with his back to me when I first saw him. He was a very peculiar-looking chap. He had a very, very long body and quite short legs, but very, very muscular and very, very evil-looking person. He just exudes evil, that's the best way I can describe it.
Pang was the ringleader, but they still had to make four other arrests that day.
The second arrested person was working, and it came, and we just suddenly found out that he was at work. So that's why I was in the office at the time, and just grabbed whoever was available and dashed down to Johnson Road, and he was there at work. There was a security officer in a building.
In fact, one of the arrested persons was arrested just opposite police headquarters. He was actually a security guard. And he was the one that was actually, when he was arrested, he was wearing Kenneth's shoes.
I mean, there was nothing spectacular about him. There was nothing, out of the ordinary. He was there in his security guard's uniform, the building security guard.
We didn't know what forensic evidence we might have. We got Kenneth's shoes, and Dave Clark, one of the brilliant forensic scientists, was able to show that Kenneth had a particular pattern in his shoe wear, inside and outside his shoes, and that this person who'd been arrested, who was wearing Kenneth's shoes, had actually imposed his shoe pattern on top of Kenneth's shoe pattern when he was wearing Kenneth's shoes over a period of time. So he was able to prove in court that by comparing the shoe patterns of Kenneth and also the arrested person's shoe patterns, that he had actually been wearing Kenneth's shoes for some several months. So that was pretty crucial evidence.
Caught red-handed wearing the shoes of the boy he had murdered. This was Tam Sei-Foon, aged just 20 years old at the time. As forensic specialist Dr. Robert Green explains, all of these little clues are vital in bringing a case together.
When we're looking to build a forensic picture, we don't often just build it on one form of evidence. So, it's a much stronger picture if we can have, some fiber evidence, if we have some blood pattern analysis, if we have some finger mark evidence, if we have some footwear evidence, it all comes together. So, we need to build that jigsaw with as many pieces as we can.
A lot of people were really happy, that, they got the Braemar Hill killers. Police got the Braemar Hill killers. They were very happy.
As Tony Flores reports, the Hong Kong public were over the moon with the arrests. But for the police officers at the heart of the operation, the arrests were just the first step.
I was very, very concerned at that time because it's one thing to arrest people and get a headline, say, oh, solve the case, but that's not my priority. My priority is to get a conviction. And not only a conviction, but a conviction that would fail on appeal. That if the conviction was appealed, the appeal would fail, and ultimately we would win in the very end and get the full conviction of all the perpetrators. That involved very careful adherence to all the rules which would be applicable in court for arresting, interrogating, using the judge's rules, as we call them, and there's no possibility of the case falling apart because some stupid detective thinks he's going to be a hero and uses physical violence totally unnecessarily on a prisoner, things of that nature. If we got a confession, I wanted to see that confession upheld in court, not thrown out in the voir dire, as we call it, a trial within a trial, to decide whether the confession is admissible in evidence or not. And quite often, if the rules are not followed, these confessions are thrown out. I didn't want to see these people walk free because of some stupidity in the way the case was handled during the arrest.
Anybody we arrested would be brought back, and we'd set up a system where we had a senior officer plus a local officer to do the interviewing, because we knew there'd be a battle at court because of the lack of the senior crime evidence.
We used some pretty, in these days, innovative techniques. Also, I insisted that the interviews would be recorded. It never happened in Hong Kong before. It was coming in the UK, video recording and audio recording of interviews, etc. And my idea was to safeguard the interviews if we got a confession, and that they would be, for the first time ever, they would be audio recorded.
Next time on Catching Worms, the confessions.
He's confessed, he said. I did it. I did that case.
In their words, have some fun.
Pang was number one, Tam was number two.
Of course, it turns into a killing frenzy.
The others were just very, very young kids.
She would have found it difficult to scream out. It was just a senseless murder.
In memory of Nicola and Kenneth, the school set up the Nicola Myers and Kenneth McBride Memorial Fund. The fund aims to support underprivileged sixth formers from across Hong Kong. If you would like to give to the fund, please see the information in the show description. This has been a Create podcast. Make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button so you never miss an episode. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then please leave us a review and a 5-star rating. It helps others to find us. You can follow us on Instagram at CatchingWormsHK. With special thanks to Detective Nori McKillop, Detective Trevor Collins, Chris Force, former teacher at Island School, John Haynes Esquire, Forensic Specialist Dr. Robert Green, Inspector Joseph Sanchez, and journalist Tony Flores. And thank you for listening.
Catching Worms, Zhuk Chong. This term means to get yourself into trouble, causing unnecessary difficulties. It may seem like an odd phrase, but this slang is often used as an abbreviation of the full saying Zhuk Chong Yap Si Fat. That involves putting said worms up your rear end, which, to anyone's imagination, definitely spells trouble indeed.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.